Hey, everyone, before we get to the show today, Ryan's got a little something going on down in Houston that he wanted to tell everybody about. Ryan?
Yeah, so we're really excited. Last time we had an event in Houston, it sold out and we had such a great time. But what we're going to do is an actual due diligence trip to Houston. It's one day. You can fly in, fly out the same day, Saturday, September 20th. We're all going to jump on a charter bus and we're going to go through and actually see how we do due diligence, select real estate, go through the purchase process. You can network, meet other aviators, meet other investors, and just have a great time. We're going to do this Saturday, September 20th in Houston, Texas. You can fly into IAH or Hobby, and we will meet at a site at around noon, conclude with a happy hour around 4 o'clock, and then you can fly out that afternoon. So if you want more information, go to the show notes. You can click to register. It's a free event, but last time it sold out, so run down to the show notes, reserve your spot today, and we'll see you in Houston, Texas.
Welcome back to Passive Income Pilots, everyone. Tate Duryea and Ryan Gibson. What's up, Ryan?
Not much. I'm excited to talk about what makes our airplanes fly.
Yeah, exactly.
We're going to talk about that fossil fuel on the ground.
That's right. We're going to talk about dinosaurs.
Yeah.
Oil and gas is a very interesting investment play. It's something I've been interested for a very long time and something I've been spending the last few years working very hard to understand better. Mark Fleming today is coming on as our oil and gas expert. He's actually our oil and gas advisor at Turbine Capital. We brought him on in Q2 of this year to help guide our decisions within the oil and gas space and to help us craft our fund that we're currently putting together. But Mark has over 20 years of experience in the oil and gas industry. He started out as a petroleum engineer, has worked for Chevron, Hess, EOG, as well as advised multiple banks in terms of lending within the energy space. So absolute wealth of knowledge. We're excited to have him on today.
Yeah. And you know what? What's really interesting, I think, is just the opportunities that are out there. You know, you can obviously invest in publicly traded energy companies and participate that way. Well, you can do that in real estate too through publicly traded REITs. But what other opportunities are there? How can you actually participate in the drilling of wells, the operations of wells, the mineral rights in the ground, maybe some infrastructure things? And that's what we're going to talk about today and really how it benefits you, right? As airline pilots, we're making more than we've ever made before. And that means that we have a tax problem. And so we talk a lot about the show. We've talked a lot about all these episodes about how you can mitigate tax risk through short-term rental loophole, through depreciation from real estate. But there's also a ton of tax benefits that you can fully take advantage of in this space. Now, before we get into the show, just as a disclaimer, I want to make sure that everybody understands we're not providing any tax, legal, or investment advice,
Absolutely.
Offering a security. This is just a friendly conversation so that you have a better understanding of what's out there. But this is not comprehensive of complete due diligence. So please do your own and be careful when investing in this space. But very excited to have a conversation with Tate and Mark.
You know, we've talked a lot about real estate on this show. I know we've turned on a lot of light bulbs when it comes to realizing what else is out there, but beyond stocks, bonds, mutual funds, and a lot of people who have listened to the show have realized, like, wow, there's all these private, you know, real estate deals you can invest in. The oil and gas space is similar to that. It is adjacent. There's all these conferences. There's a huge industry around this, both on the business side of things and the investment side of things. So we're excited to shed a little bit of light on that today.
And with that, let's get to it.
Let's get to the show.
Welcome to Passive Income Pilots, where pilots upgrade their money. This is the definitive source for personal finance and investment tactics for aviators. We interview world-renowned experts and share these lessons with the flying community. So if you're ready for practical knowledge and insights, let's roll.
Mark, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks, Tate. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you on. We've been working together for the last few months, and you are an absolute wealth of knowledge. So we are very bullish on the oil and gas space. It's something that Turbine Capital has committed to firmly for the foreseeable future. But excited to get into all things energy today. Ryan.
Yeah, I'm dying. I'm dying to ask a question.
For the first question, yes.
Yes. So my, as an airline pilot, if I've never invested in oil and natural gas, or oil and gas, I should say, what do I need to know? Like what are the options out there? What's available to me? What do I need to know? And, explain it to me like I just started learning how to fly an airplane. Like I know nothing about this. Kind of talk me through how you would explain that to somebody.
Well, obviously, for your industry, it's a very important product to have, right? But in terms of investing in oil and gas, I think I think there's a lot of bad press out there. There's been a lot of TV shows and personalities involved in the business that probably gave it a bad name. But it's been around since the 1800s, and it's used worldwide now, and it drives the world. There's not much that you touch or see every day that doesn't come from oil and gas. Even in the renewable space, almost all those products are made from oil and gas, and it takes oil and gas to keep them running, and it takes oil and gas to get rid of them when they're done. So it's a very important product to the world, as I'm sure you know. There's some great references to that, which we'll post here on the site later. In terms of investing in oil and gas, traditionally there have just been, up until maybe 10 or 15 years ago, have just been oil and gas major company stocks where you could get, a nice return, a nice dividend. And if you held on to it long enough, which is very important to remember, there's a lot of money to be made. If you'd bought ExxonMobil stock, 50 years ago, you'd 10x your money easy, if not more. But that kind of brings us to one of the other points there. This is not a get rich quick scheme. There are some people that do that in the oil and gas business, and they're day traders and whatnot that trade, pray for wars or no war or, silly things like that and make a lot of money, but you can also lose a lot of money really quick. So it's important to understand that it's a long term business. And when I say long term, I would say your average investment needs to be held at least 5 years. You might make your money back sooner than that, but 5 years is a good time, a good projection for making your money back. And the reason I say that is mostly because of pricing. If we had stable pricing, this would be a lot easier to predict, but it's, the world decides the pricing on oil and gas, not just the U.S. China, Russia, and politics decide the oil and gas prices. What I'm excited about right now, despite the drill baby drill talk and all that, is just some consistency in the business. Right now, we've got a pro-energy government. We've got a Secretary of Energy that was in the energy business and writes one of the documents that we're going to post. And there's just nothing crazy going on in the business, which is what we like. We want stability. We want to be able to buy products, use them, services to drill oil and gas wells, and then sell our product out on the market, maybe even hedge and guarantee to the best that we can our returns. And that's what we're doing here.
You mentioned, drill baby drill and the administration and now's a good time and things like that. How dependent is this investment on the political climate?
It's not dependent on the climate, but it can be affected by it if there's volatility. And that's what we don't want. We don't want wars. We don't want, just crazy things going on between different countries to where we can't sell products to each other. So now that, a lot of that, I think, is settled, you're seeing some stability in the oil price. So we'd like it to be a little higher. But remember that we buy things from other companies as well to drill oil and gas wells. And so they're trying to base their expenses on products that they have to get sometimes, which come from other countries, which have been affected by tariffs. And so we want to be able to drill wells for a certain amount of money and not have to spend too much. So if I were to drill a $10 million well and did my projections on $80 oil, and then all of a sudden oil drops to 60, well, it still costs me the same amount to drill that well because I haven't renegotiated any contracts with anybody. So now I'm making 20% less revenue, but I have to spend the same amount to drill the well. So that's where we just want stability, because if prices, stay lower like they are now, a lot of the costs that we're facing right now should start coming down.
I'd like to give you an opportunity to speak through your background in your own words. We referenced it in the intro, but you've been in this industry for a very long time, started as a petroleum engineer. I'd love to hear about your background, your experience over the decades in the industry, and how the industry has maybe changed or matured in that time.
Sure. So I got master's and bachelor's degree in petroleum engineering. Very exciting. Had a lot of relatives in the oil business in Houston that we used to visit every summer. So they got me interested in it, and it was good for me. My dad was an engineer for NASA, so kind of a scientific background in my house. Started out working for Chevron. Very excited about that. At Midland, that was just a whirlwind. Midland was a neat place, and it's still the king of oil and gas in the U.S. The Permian Basin. If you ever go out there, you'll see. If you've flown over there, you know, you just have to look out the window and see thousands of little white dots. You know, where the I'm sure you know what I'm talking about, where all the pump jacks are. I also did my master's degree on U.S. energy policy, which I thought was very fascinating. You know, we didn't have an energy policy for a long time. And then I think it was Carter that had the first one, or maybe right before him, we started deciding that, you know, politics was important, you know, when it comes to energy as well. And so early on in my career, you know, it was looking like the U.S. was not even going to come close to, you know, to replacing its own production, that we were going to need oil and gas from a lot of other places. And that's why politics comes into play. So, you know, we were getting as much as 50% of our own gas from other countries. I helped a company in Lafayette do a startup during kind of the dot-com era in the early 2000s. That was really neat to get on the stock market and go public and get involved with that side of oil and gas. But one of the things that's changed significantly, and I was working for Hess at the time, is the unconventional plays, they call it, that have come on production in the U.S. We went from being a net importer of oil and gas to a net exporter in about a 15-year period. And if you go look at the numbers on that, that's a world-class feat for somebody, for a country to be able to do that with a product that's used so much. We were building LNG ports at the time to import LNG from other countries. And most of those got turned right around to be export facilities. And now there's 10 or so more being built. I mean, we did an about face from an energy standpoint. And that just doesn't happen in a whole lot of industries that matter as much as oil and gas. So I'm excited to be part of it. It's gone from people thinking oil and gas was going to be gone, you know, by 2050, you know, it looks now like there's another 100 or 2 years worth of oil and gas. Another good example of that is the ExxonMobil and Hess discovery in Guyana. It's one of the biggest oil and gas fields discovered in the last 50 years, and it's humongous. There's 4 FPSOs online already, and we just, you know, it was unthought of to think that there was, nobody thought something like that was going to happen again. And so it's good to see money going back in the business, and good to see investments.
Yeah. So speaking of that, my understanding is a lot of this new found oil supply has come from technology changes in the last 10 or 20 years. Could you kind of speak to what those technological advances were and maybe how it relates to participating and maybe investing in some of that infrastructure capability that we have?
Sure. So one of the things that changed significantly was the amount of time it takes to drill a well. It used to take a month or longer to drill a 1-mile well. And of course, when I'm talking about a horizontal well, which is what they're drilling now, which is also not how oil and gas fields were traditionally developed. So not only have we gone horizontal with these wells, but they're drilling 4-mile wells now and getting them drilled in a matter of 2 or 3 weeks. So there's been a lot of technology change in drilling. And then in completing the wells also, I mean, there's a lot of press around fracking. That's not new. I did some fracking in the late 80s in a summer job. So it's not anything new, but the technology behind that has changed significantly. We are getting a lot more oil and gas out of the ground because of that. And that's only in the U.S. Unconventional plays really haven't even taken off in any other countries. There's some companies like EOG that are just starting to look internationally to see if they can do the same thing in other countries. But just think if that same effort could be duplicated, you know, in another country, how much more oil and gas could be made.
I do want to be sensitive to, you know, the environmental concerns and sort of address the elephant in the room there. You know, I've said on the show before that I'm a little bit of a tree hugger at heart, but I'm also an investor and a realist in the fact that, you know, when you look at global energy consumption, we're still 83% fossil fuel based. After trillions of dollars pouring into the green energy space, we've gotten 17% green. And as you mentioned before, you know, it takes oil and gas to build a windmill. It takes petroleum products to build the composites and the plastics and, you know, to lubricate the parts. And so it's very difficult to get away from that. I'm excited to see what technology develops around carbon capture and ways that we can mitigate. But, you know, the reality is, you know, a 7.4 or a 7.3 isn't going to be powered by hydrogen or electrics anytime in the near future. And so when we are looking at this space, you know, we've seen a large drawdown in institutional funding because of environmental social governance, because of political pressures over the last decade. And so we just see this as an interesting time, to say the least, to be investing in the space. So, you know, the idea here is just purely education, understanding. I think it's funny to me that, you know, before I really started going down the rabbit hole and understanding this space as an industry and also as an investment, the fact that it gets this bad rap, yet people sit on an airplane that burns, you know, tens of thousands of pounds of fuel going from point A to point B, and they go to the gas station without really thinking about it. It's almost like, you know, people that say, you know, look down on hunting, yet they'll go to the store and buy meat products. So I think that there's a reality that needs to be addressed. And in any case, it's a fascinating space. So when you start peeling back the onion and demystifying it, it's a pretty amazing industry and something that touches, as we said earlier, something that touches everything.
Agreed. And what we can do as an oil and gas business is we can't solve all those problems, but we can at least produce our product in a cleaner manner. And so that's something that's gotten a lot of attention. You know, everybody's got an ESG group in their company now, and they're paying, you know, a lot more attention to that. But on that note also, natural gas is so much cleaner.
That's what I was going to bring up.
Than oil and coal. And so if we have to use one of those going forward, natural gas is you know, my vote for the clean energy of the future, maybe along with nuclear, but that takes a different effort to get that up and running.
Well, and we were at a energy conference in Fort Worth earlier this year called Superdug. And, you know, one of the big macroeconomic trends right now is AI and the massive energy that is needed to power the AI boom. And the, you know, really the conversation around that conference was natural gas is going to be the capacitor. It's going to be the energy source that gets us that bridges the gap, essentially. And the reason why natural gas is so clean is because there's, what is it, 5 hydrogen atoms and 1 carbon atom. So it's mostly hydrogen and much mm-hmm. less carbon. But in any case, let's talk about the what happens when you drill a well. You know, you get oftentimes a mix of both, right?
So there are I call them plays that are different in the different parts of the U.S. and around the world. And each one of them is known for either being an oil or a gas play. And what that means is that's the predominant fluid that comes out, you know, of the well. So in an oil play, you know, the oil can be very light, sometimes called sweet, or it also can be very heavy and takes a lot of processing, you know, costs a lot more to get, you know, to get turned into a commercial product. Along with those, that oil, though, gas comes along the way. And so gas does get produced with all oil wells. Now, on the flip side of that, there are natural gas fields and natural gas reservoirs, such as the Haynesville, which is in a great place. It's in North Louisiana. It's very close to several LNG facilities. And there's a lot of activity there, and there's a lot of companies buying assets in there to supply their LNG plants, even from different countries. And so that is, you know, clean gas for the most part, and liquids come out of it as well, but it's usually very light, very thin, probably something you could burn in an airplane or a race car. And so that's what comes in. A lot of times it's a mixture of the two.
So just kind of boiling down to like sort of how an investor, you know, you mentioned stocks and participating in the publicly traded opportunities. But my understanding is that there's really kind of 3 ways that you can invest potentially into one of these privately, right? Because, I mean, our listeners of our show really kind of look for ways that they can kind of diversify outside of the stock market. I mean, you can buy a real estate investment trust in the stock market. You can buy sort of pieces of that. But then you can also, you know, do what a lot of us do, which is invest directly into real estate. Similar to that, you know, you can invest in private funds. And my understanding is there's things like a working interest where you can invest directly in a drilling project. there is a royalty interest or like mineral rights where you can kind of buy the minerals under the soil. And then the last one was kind of like infrastructure investing where you're kind of building out the pipeline. And those are a little bit more rare to find. And then different kind of vehicles, right? Where maybe you could be like in an LP fund that's doing a little bit of all these things, or maybe there's a aggregate of wells. But can you kind of speak to like sort of those different things, maybe some pros and cons of each, and kind of give investors like a kind of an idea of what goes on out there, and you know, kind of get into that?
Sure. Yeah, well, let's start with the big picture. You know, most of the big oil and gas companies operate their own oil and gas wells. They go explore, they hire lots of staff, they buy land, they have landmen, and they, you know, and it's a pretty big effort to go. EOG is a great example. If you want to go read about them, they are the ones that find a lot of these new oil and gas plays. But you know, they've got a big company to do that, and so that would be the big picture. You know, an operated oil and gas company, and you could certainly try and do that yourself if you wanted to. There are a lot of little guys that do that, but that's a good way to lose a lot of money to try and do that on your own just because of the expenses.
And when you say explore, like they're literally going out, they're finding land and they're drilling, and they may or may not hit
Correct.
Oil.
They're running seismic, which costs hundreds of thousands of dollars. The land costs hundreds of thousands of dollars. It's, you know, it's an expensive game, but you know, there's people that are doing that and doing well. I mean, that's what Exxon and Hess did in Guyana 15 years ago. And now they've got 4 floating production storage units online, making 1 million barrels a day. They're doing all right. You know, and that's kind of the second part of that, which is new. So when I was early on in the business, nobody wanted to be a non-operator. You just couldn't control anything. We all wanted to do our own thing and control our own destiny. So that really was not thought of as a profitable business, to be honest with you. But over the last 20 years, and probably especially the last 10, there have been a lot of companies that have come out and said, hey, I want to, you know, I like this business. I've got a lot lower overhead. I don't have to do the exploration dollars. I don't have to do all the upfront work. I'm just going to participate in somebody else as well. And you might ask, you know, if I'm an oil and gas company, why would I need somebody to help me out with a well? Well, let's just say, you know, it's the month of August, your budget is X, your capital in the bank is X, and the oil price goes down and you're not making as much money that month, but you've got a 10-well drilling commitment. So you have two choices. You can borrow some additional money against your revolver, or you could get some help. And so a lot of these companies, this is a big business now, will say, hey, you know what? We're going to go ahead and sell this down by 15%. We're still going to operate. We're still going to be the guys that drill the well, but we're going to bring in a trusted capital partner to help us with this well. And so let's take that to the third stage there. If you're that person that's just investing in somebody else's, you know, non-op well, you know, they've done all the work. Now they're going to probably charge you a little bit for that. There's a fee, but you're getting handed almost a opportunity to participate in something that would have taken you years and a staff to get a hold of, to be honest with you. So it you know, there's a lot of people that are investing that in funds just as ours, such as ours, are looking at that. So these are opportunities to participate with well-known operators in wells that are just about to be drilled, but we didn't have to hire anybody. We didn't have to buy the land 10 years ago. We didn't have to shoot the seismic. We didn't have to do any of the, we didn't have to organize the frac crew, the drilling rig. You know, there's a lot of work that goes on to get an oil well drilled. We didn't have to invest in the pipelines. I mean, we didn't, you know, we're just coming in and cutting a check. So that has turned out to be a very good and very profitable business. And there are lots of oil and gas funds right now doing just that. And there's some companies that are doing that on their own without other people's money, but they're staying a non-op, you know, partner and using their own funds. And then you mentioned the midstream. That's kind of a second part of the business. That's very typically not associated with an oil and gas company unless you're really big. That used to not be the case either. I know when I was with Hess, we owned pipelines and producing facilities, and we all the way down to the gas station. That's the way the big oil companies used to do it, is they wanted it from beginning to end. Well, as of, I don't know, about 10 years ago, that all got sold off. So there are very few oil and gas companies that own, you know, from the ground all the way to the final product. And so that's where you enter all these midstream companies that have gone and bought pipeline pipelines all over the U.S. and they're building new pipelines. And then they structure deals with the operator. So that's a, you know, that's a very profitable business as well. For the last 4 or 5 years, you know, the Permian Basin has not had enough takeaway capacity, so the gas has not been worth anything. And I think I saw a press release just the other day. They finally got a transmission pipeline going over to the Phoenix area, and there's more of those in the works. But you know, you got to be able to sell it too. So that's a profitable business as well.
So to clarify here, when we talk about drilling, that's oftentimes referred to as upstream.
Correct.
Pipeline and offtake capability is referred to as midstream. Yes. And midstream, you can invest in midstream. It's almost like triple net in real estate. It's less volatile, just an easy cash coupon. However, the tax benefits really lie, and this is something that I just authored an ebook on with my tax strategist, Nathan Sosa, earlier this year. We released it in the spring. And there are some pretty incredible tax benefits associated with non-op working interests when you're actually investing in the drill play. When you are actually poking holes in the ground, you can write off, you know, sometimes 80 to 85% of your investment amount against active W-2 income. And that's something that is unique to oil and gas. I'd like to unpack why those tax benefits exist from your words, Mark. You know, when we were having dinner in Houston, we were talking about, you know, these rules being written back when the industry was a bit more risky, and not to discount the risks, because they're, you know, this is not buying a stabilized self-storage portfolio. You know, this is not buying an existing multifamily building that's 90 or 95% occupied. This is something that entails definitely more risk than a typical real estate deal, but it's got a much different risk profile today than it maybe did 30 years ago, 40 years ago when these rules were written. Do you want to speak to that at all?
Sure. So back when these rules were written is the time I was talking about, when it was looking like we were going to be a net importer of oil, you know, forever. And so we were trying to encourage additional oil and gas drilling. And that was one way to do it, was to give tax credits for drilling the wells. So, you know, it's good policy. I'm very glad that during the recent, you know, political environments that hasn't changed. There's been a lot of pressure to get rid of those, but it hasn't, you know, that hasn't gone through, thank goodness, and they're still there. And once again, you know, that's a fantastic opportunity, because you just didn't have to do anything hardly as a non-op partner to get this well to fruition. And now you're getting to participate in it, and you're getting a tax advantage. I mean, that it's really a great thing that a lot of companies, you know, understand. And that's why I think there are so many funds that do this because of that. I mean, you might call it a loophole. I don't know, because the risk of getting a good oil and gas well is much less now than it was beforehand. When those laws were implemented, there was a lot of true exploration going on where you might hit 1 out of 10 wells. And right now, it's more like 9 out of 10 wells in some of these unconventional plays. Obviously, there's still risk involved. You've got pricing, amongst other things. But, you know, I think it's a much better investment now than it was then. And so I'm glad that those benefits still stay around. And I hope they stay around forever. I know there's been mention of it recently that, you know, there's no intention of anybody in this administration cutting that.
And speaking of administrations, you know, another thing that I thought was really interesting at the conference was, you know, everybody was laughing about drill baby drill. You know, nobody's out there saying drill baby drill at $65 a barrel oil. So Trump might be saying that, but none of these oil companies are saying, yay, let's go out and drill our hearts out. It is a much more disciplined industry today than it was, you know, back in even the early 2010s. Because oil prices, you know, oil companies kind of got smacked in 2016 when we saw that big crash in oil prices, and then again during COVID. So it's a disciplined industry today versus back then. So what I think the sentiment is that people are, it's a welcome change that there's at least stability in policy, where you can get permits, you know what the next few years is going to look like in terms of what can be accomplished.
I would totally agree with that. And you haven't seen any new regulations against the industry either. No more there's been nothing put off limits. In fact, some of the previous policies have been reversed so that there can now be oil and gas sales in the Gulf of Mexico again and other places.
Well, and when we talk about offtake capability, you know, we used to fly to Austin and we'd come in the early morning, you'd fly over the Permian, you'd see all of this flaring. And it's because there's no pipelines. And so if there's no permits to put pipelines in, all this valuable natural gas is just being flared into the atmosphere instead of actually going to a useful purpose. And so I think that there's ways to be more pragmatic.
Keep your eye on data centers.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, obviously with a combination of new technologies like nuclear, but natural gas being an amazing source of energy for those data centers, particularly if they're built close to the source, because natural gas is more of a local commodity.
There's plans being announced for quite a number of these around the country. I mean, it's in place, equipment's being ordered. It's not a dream anymore. They're gonna have natural gas power data centers in 5 or 6 different places in the U.S. probably in the next year or two, which is great. It's fast, very fascinating.
I think we've done a good job laying out sort of the opportunity. You know, we have a ton of demand and need and probably a better framework to work within, great technology, an abundant resource here. And really, it's gotten, like you said, Mark, it's gotten a bit safer. It's still, as Tate alluded to, it's not risk-free. This isn't the least... you know, the safest thing to do, but you know, but it's gotten a lot more advanced, right? Which you said, like maybe out of hitting 1 out of 10, maybe you're hitting 9 out of 10. So what are the risks though? Cause I kind of feel like, I feel like the risks are, it always kind of boils down to partnering with the wrong person, right? So, you know, you can have a great opportunity and get the wrong person that sort of hides behind it and you get into the wrong deal. So kind of how do you sort of due diligence on sort of an operator or an opportunity to make sure that it's legitimate and, you know, and that you can trust passively investing with this person?
Well, first of all, the oil business is not a secretive business. Everybody knows everybody. You can read everybody's financial statements. There's 9 or 10 conferences a year alive. You're paying attention to what other people are doing. So it's kind of hard for somebody to hide what they're doing, and it's also hard for someone to get away with being a really good company and not knowing what they do. People follow EOG all the time and go hire, you know, the guys that completed their well so that they can find out how to complete their own well. So it's a dog eat dog business, but I think that's a good thing because we all know what everybody else is doing. But you know that everybody also has to publicize their data. So oil and gas production, how much comes out of the ground, you know, what kind of completion they did, that's all public data. And so it's not cheap, but it's data that we can look at to assess whether somebody, you know, did well or not. And if you combine that with their, you know, their financial statements, you can get a pretty good, you know, maybe look at their stock price, what's the market sentiment as well. I think you can get a pretty good feel for who's a good operator, who's a leader, and who's, you know, who's a follower. And that's one of the things I'm doing for this group is, you know, when we get a group of wells that we've been asked to invest in, I'm doing that homework. You know, how does this company look? Who did they buy the assets from? What did the previous company look like? And you know, is there anybody around them that's doing better? Or is there any, you know, are most people doing worse? And then I'm going to go back and, you know, kind of gut check that with some prior performance from some other projects maybe that they were involved in. So, you know, you got to do your due diligence on each of these companies and the areas that they're invested in.
Yeah, makes sense.
What's the best way to lose money in oil and gas?
To just maybe invest in one well, especially an exploration well. That's what's gotten the industry a bad name is, you know, going back to the Dallas show and all that kind of stuff. Just, people just thought that was oil and gas where you drill one well, you know, and it either works, makes you a billionaire or it doesn't. And that is kind of how it used to be honest with you. But it's not that way anymore. And the best way to make money is to invest in a group of oil and gas wells and not just one or two or three.
What would be kind of your top 3 criteria? If you're looking at an opportunity, what are you saying, hey, this meets my mark, this meets my, you know, for example, like in storage, you know, I might think about a location that has dense population, unmet demand, well located on a main road and well occupied market. What would be your like talking points on, you know, saying, oh, this is a good deal because of these things?
So for me, it would be a good basin. You know, I use the Haynesville as an example. This is in North Louisiana. It's got a lot of oil and gas there, mostly natural gas. It's clean, and it's in the vicinity of pipelines that come down to the Gulf Coast and feed LNG facilities. So you get good money for your product. So good reservoir and good takeaway capacity. Those have to go together. I mean, an example of where that doesn't work very well is Permian Basin gas. You can't sell it. And so that problem is going to be solved, but that wouldn't be the highest on my list. Then right behind that, though, is the operator that you're dealing with. You know, like I mentioned earlier, they do learn from each other. And so I think eventually everybody figures out how to do things the best. But, you know, you might as well get in there with the guys that are doing it right the first time and making, you know, far less mistakes.
You know, I'd love for you to talk through a little bit of the work that you've been doing for us, actually, in terms of looking at the geotechnical, looking at the formation, looking at past performance of some of these operators, and you know how you can, because there's the wonderful thing about non-op, like you said, is, you know, if EOG or Continental has already poured millions and millions of dollars into doing the research and the geotechnical engineering, and they're going to go spend tens of millions of dollars in drilling these wells, you know, do we need to redo their homework? Or, you know, what is your process to, you know, weed out whether this is a good opportunity or not?
So first thing I'm going to do is, you know, give you my opinion on the basin that they're in. You know, there's some that I don't like, so that, you know, probably I don't know if I'd invest in them just yet until they're a little further discovered. I was at a meeting just yesterday where we were talking about new unconventional areas that are being developed right now. That's fascinating, but that's not where I'd put, you know, your 401k money right now until someone else proves it up a little bit more. So, you know, we've got to have a good basin to be in. And then we're going to do a deep dive. So if someone says, hey, you know, let's participate in these 10 wells, I'm going to draw a circle around those on a map and look at, you know, a couple hundred wells in the area, just get an idea for trends. You know, how long are the wells being drilled? You know, how long do they take to get permitted? You know, if I can get the information, you know, how much do they cost and what are they producing? And then we'll use that information to take a look at what the investor has sent us and compare it to and say, you know, are they over promising their wells? You know, I mean, everybody's a salesman, understood, but we need to make sure that what they're showing us that's to be drilled makes sense to us. And so we're going to go do our own economics, you know, down to the well level and say, hey, does each one of these wells look like it's going to work out? And, you know, if we put them all together as a group and maybe, you know, put a little risk on it just because, you know, every now and then something doesn't go well, is it still, you know, going to work for us? And we'll also do sensitivities to, you know, cost increases, timing delays, and most importantly, pricing. And that kind of gets back to the investment, you know, methodology from the beginning. You know, this just is not a get rich quick scheme. I mean, it'd be great if oil went to 100 and stayed there for a year and this investment paid out inside of a year. That'd be great. It happens. But you know, who knows? It might go down to 50 or 40 for a year or two, and we have to sit on it and just kind of wait and see what happens. You got to be patient.
I can certainly say, as an airline pilot, you know, you have a balancing of the scales, because if oil goes to $100 a barrel, your airline job is not as secure. I can tell you that, right?
Right. I don't even know. Do the airlines hedge for oil and gas?
Definitely. The airlines massively hedge.
Totally. Yeah. I wanted to talk more about the tax benefits. I know, Tate, you talked about your ebook, and we'll put a plug to your ebook in the show notes. But how does it work? You know, we talk a lot on the show about not being able to take full advantage of depreciation against our earned income because of depreciation, right? So in real estate, there's a whole bunch of things that we talk about in the previous episodes where you can do the short-term rental loophole and you can do a short-term rental and you can take advantage of that depreciation against your earned income. Then our syndications in real estate also have depreciation, but you really can't use that against your earned income,
right,
unless you partner with a spouse that has real estate rep status or you become a professional real estate. Now, you can still use that depreciation against your distributions, which is a major advantage. How does it work in oil and gas? Can you use this against your earned income? Do you have to do anything fancy like rep status, or how does that work?
Mark, you want to take that one, or you want me to
I'll let you handle that one.
Yeah, I can take this one. So the big write-offs come from IDCs, so intangible drilling costs. So all of the engineering costs, the fuel, the labor, all of the costs that it takes to put that well in the ground are able to be taken as intangible drilling costs. And that's about 80 to 85% of all of the write-offs. The remaining 10 to 20% is going to come from depletion and depreciation. So depreciation, just like you're familiar with real estate, and also the depletion allowance. That allows you to take the phantom losses of the costs to put this well in the ground and take it against active W-2 income. Now, the key is that you have to be a general partner in the year that the wells are drilled. So this is the downside, is in real estate, if you put $50,000 into a deal and you're a limited partner, if someone slips, trips, dies on the property, you are limited to that $50,000. That $50,000 is all that you can lose because you are a limited partner. And this is why we say that investors are welcome to invest via their personal name into a syndication deal, is because, you know, there's no liability associated with that asset to you. That is not a liability generating investment. Now, an oil and gas deal, technically, in order to write this off against your W-2 income, you have to come in as a GP in the current year, and you have to have unlimited liability in the deal in order to unlock these tax benefits. So we talk about this thoroughly in this ebook, but the reality is it's not as big of a deal as you might think. You know, these projects have massive insurance policies that you know, protect you from some sort of environmental disaster, but you have to be comfortable with that risk, knowing that if there was some disaster, you would be on the hook for potentially more than you put into the deal. So we'll have a lot more information on the offering that we have forthcoming around this topic, but that's one of the key differentiators. But what we'll do is we'll bring everybody in as a general partner in 2025, and then on January 1st of 2026, everybody flips to a limited partner. So you take on this liability in, you know, for about a quarter, and then you flip to an LP. But that's kind of how the tax benefits work. There are also some tax benefits in terms of when the money starts coming back to you the following year. There's some tax advantages there as well. But it's in the show notes. Highly recommend giving it a read. You don't need to give us your email or anything to download it. It'll just link right out to a Google Doc. You can check it out.
That's awesome. Just yet another way to save money. Can I use my self-directed IRA to invest in this?
You absolutely can. However, you lose the tax benefit. So I would not any tax, legal, or investment advice, right? But I'd much rather see you invest in a self-storage deal with Ryan or a multifamily deal over here or you know, something else with your self-directed IRA, because there's some really powerful tax benefits with the oil and gas. It just makes a whole heck of a lot more sense to use cash.
So when I think about risk and portfolio allocation, I tend to think of the 10-30-30-30 allocation strategy, where 10% of my net worth is always going to be in cash and cash equivalents. It's liquid, it's emergency fund. The next 30% of my portfolio would be in things that are like managed money, like stocks, bonds, mutual funds, traditional investments that are highly liquid, meaning I can push a button and I can get that back. Then the next 30% would be in things like real estate, things that I control, that I can create liquidity, but it might take me a few months to do it. And then lastly, things like syndications and private placements. Where is this on the sort of, you know, if I'm a brand new pilot and I've got my first 50 grand, or I'm a senior captain and I've maxed out my stock, you know, portfolio investing the last, my 401k the last, I don't know, two decades. And, you know, kind of where on the spectrum am I thinking about how this fits into my portfolio from terms of like risk and allocation?
Great question. I can field this. It's definitely more on the advanced side. I think that, you know, you definitely don't want this to be your first $50,000 to be in an oil and gas deal. There are two levers, and Mark, you can speak to this, but there are two big levers that will affect returns in oil and gas that we have absolutely no control over. One is pricing. So the price of oil and gas goes up, we're going to do really well. Price goes down, well, we model this, you know, in our sensitivity. Well, we'll have a lot more information on it, but we have no control over pricing. We also have no control over production. And, you know, we get a pretty good idea of how these assets are going to perform. But at the end of the day, until the wells are drilled and brought online, Mark, do you want to speak to that? And then I can speak more to, you know, the structure of your portfolio.
Sure. So I was talking earlier that, you know, when they tell us where they're going to drill the wells, we're going to look at offset wells. Sometimes maybe this operator hasn't drilled yet, so we've got to base it on what some other people have done. In this case, the operator has drilled a few wells, but they're only barely coming on production. So we're still in the assessment phase. And I think we have, you know, we have 50 or so wells in our model to that, you know, we use to build this model. So I think we're in a good spot. But we'll go back every month though and look at them and make sure they're online with what we were thinking. But yeah, we're gonna continually update our model as we go along and as we get into new basins. And you know, and the more of these you do, the better it is. The more data you get and the more history you get with other operators. And to that extent as well, you know, it might be possible in the future to hedge a little bit also if we get a bigger portfolio to prevent, you know, some downsides, you know, and to kind of at least guarantee a certain amount of income. That's not going to be too easy to do with a 10 well portfolio, but you know, if you were to get a, you know, couple of hundred well portfolio built up, then that's a very distinct possibility.
Well, and we're planning for 2025, we'll have 50 to 75 wells in this portfolio. But Ryan, to answer your question, you know, it definitely falls in that 30% of illiquid syndications. However, what I love about this space, and I've been a real estate guy for a very long time, what I love about this space is the velocity of money. And when you invest in a real estate deal, typically you put 100K in, 50K in, whatever it is, and then you're waiting for 5 years, 6 years, sometimes even longer for that to mature. And you're getting some small amounts of cash flow along the way, but it's not changing your life. And you have a lot of money tied up in these deals, and you're waiting for all of them to finally mature years down the road. Oil and gas works differently, where there's heavy cash flow up front and you actually have a depreciating asset, truly depreciating, meaning it's actually worth less year after year after year. So that well is most valuable when it's first drilled, you get this big wave of cash flow up front, and then it slowly declines over time. And then if you were to hold it, I mean, there are some wells that produce for 40, 50, sometimes even longer years. But they depreciate in value over time until they're worth nothing at the very end of their lifespan. But what that does is it's the opposite cash flow of real estate, where you have this upfront, and it really helps you get that avalanche of that snowball going in terms of having money deployed, money coming back in, money reinvesting. So I appreciate the fact that it is faster to return capital than real estate. And I think it balances real estate very nicely.
That's great. So Tate, can you kind of speak to what investments you're targeting? You know, we talked about the three, right? The minerals, the drilling, you know, the infrastructure. What are you guys looking at? Are you guys looking into mineral right plays or drilling or exploration? Like, kind of where do you guys fit into that?
I'll pass this over to Mark, but before I do, I'll say that, you know, we've done two oil and gas deals so far, but they've been focused on PDP, which is proved developed producing assets, where we've bought existing assets. So you can think of a multifamily, right, or the Houston storage. It's already built. It's already online. It's already got tenants in it. Essentially, the well's already been drilled, and it's already throwing off a cash flow stream. We're just buying an existing asset. The issue with that is there's no tax benefits. Mineral rights are fantastic as well. No tax benefits. But you know, we brought Mark on earlier this year to help us do the due diligence, ask the right questions, and guide our decision-making in terms of the fund that we're currently putting together. So Mark, I'll pitch it over to you and talk more about what the exact strategy is for this fund.
Sure. So I don't think we're going to participate in exploration with this fund. That might be something the Skunk Works division can do. But for this fund, it's going to be something that you'd, you know, put your grandma's money in, savings account in. And so they're going to be, and I don't think we're going to invest in minerals either, because we've been touting the tax benefits, you know, as a part of this fund. So I think we're going to stick in the non-op space for a while. There'll be small interests, and with the amount of money that we're looking to spend, they kind of need to be small interests at the time so that we can get in enough wells to mitigate the risk. And so further on down the line, we may be able to increase that. I don't know. But my personal interest would be to get in as many wells as we can in several different basins and get a good database built to where we have our own direct comparisons for investments. So if someone comes to us, I'd like to be in four or five of these different basins, and then we can do our comparison. And hey, you know, that well doesn't look like it's going to be as good as the one we're already a part of, or hey, that looks like it's going to be better. And so we'll have our own, you know, internal knowledge then, I guess you could say, to for comparison.
Well, I appreciate your acumen in the space. Mark, before we break, we want to be respectful of your time, of course. You mentioned a few resources ahead of the show that we wanted to share with people, and we'll link to these in the show notes, but Bettering Human Lives by Chris Wright and The Prize by Daniel Yeren. Do you want to just talk through those?
Yeah, sure. So The Prize, probably one of the best books I've ever read, actually won the Pulitzer Prize, which is kind of odd for an oil and gas book that most people think that's boring, but it's a really, well, it has good pictures in it too. But it's a really good book that just takes you back to the beginning of oil and gas. And I would say it doesn't lean any specific political way or towards any different country. It is just a history of how it started and kind of where we, not now, it's a 20-year-old book, but it almost kind of doesn't matter when you read it. It talks about the Middle East and how that came about and how politics have a lot to do with oil and gas. Fantastic book. And then, of course, we're blessed right now to have our current Secretary of Energy, Chris Wright, you know, have come from the energy industry. His company has kind of gone way above the call of duty, I'll say, and started putting together documentation kind of for everybody in the world to understand how this business works and how it affects, you know, poverty and what products, you know, are you, the oil and gas, you know, what, how are they used? How, you know, where are we headed from an environmental standpoint? What are the different forms of energy? It's just a great book. It's called, or it's a PDF actually. It's called Bettering Human Lives. If you want to, you know, go toe to toe with someone on oil and gas industry facts and not opinion, read that and try and commit some of it to memory. It's just a great book. Great read.
We'll link to those in the show notes.
Well, thanks so much, Mark, for coming on and sharing your wisdom with us. And thanks for tuning in this week. We hope to catch you on the next episode. Thanks, everybody. And before we jump off, remember, join our Facebook group, Passive Income Pilots, where you can jump into the conversations happening and ask any questions that you might have.
Thank you.
Thanks everybody.
Take care.